Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Shasai and I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, a recent report shows the minimum wage in Nova Scotia is far below what the calculated livable wage should be. Justice for Workers Nova Scotia says employers should step in and pay more than what is required by law.
We're seeing a lot of different crises converge all at once, and what's really making people feel the strain when it comes to their paycheck.
People on welfare in Quebec say they feel imprisoned by a rule that forbids them to leave the province more than a week at a time.
You feel like you're being surveilled all the time. They don't do it actively because they don't have the means to do it, but they have the legal means to do it.
In British Columbia, the Oceanside Task Force is hoping to build 24 tiny homes for the homeless.
If we can do something in the short term that, you know, gives people some dignity and a place to call their own off of the streets and being able to move forward, I think we should be doing it.
And the play Give Him Hell looks back at history, chronicling the fight waged by some Peterborough students a decade ago to keep their school from closing.
PCBS was like visiting another planet. It was just, well, for starters, it was such a beautiful building. The students there were so passionate about saving the school, and this was entirely driven by students in their final year of school. So they were trying to save the school for future generations. It wasn't even for them. It was completely selfless.
This and more on Viewpoints.
Local news nationwide.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Thanks so much for keeping us company. We first turn to the East Coast, where a recent report from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives Nova Scotia, released on September 7th, shows the province is struggling to meet livable wages. The study provides a look at how much per hour is needed to meet basic needs in different regions of the province. A minimum wage in Nova Scotia is set to increase to $15 an hour on October 1st, but Suzanne McNeil from Justice for Workers Nova Scotia says it's not nearly enough. She says the living wage should be close to $27 per hour in Halifax, $22 in Cape Breton, and $25 in the Annapolis Valley. This year's year-over-year increase on calculated living wages was 14%, the highest jump since the living wage calculating started in 2015. Haley DiRizio in Halifax spoke to Suzanne McNeil from Justice for Workers Nova Scotia about how an increase in the minimum wage is needed and the benefits that would come from it.
It's a bit jarring to see how big of a jump the living wage calculations made this year from last year. You know, we're not entirely surprised to see those numbers because we know from having conversations with people in the course of doing, you know, getting them to sign our petition, we know that a lot of people are struggling and that, you know, their wages are just not keeping up with what they need. We were really interested to see how high it was, you know, in Halifax certainly, but also just across the province. The minimum wage is going to reach $15 an hour this fall in October. We were originally supposed to reach $15, you know, this coming spring, but the province accelerated the timeline a bit and for good reason. But, you know, $15 is not going to get people where they need to go. And we believe the minimum wage needs to be much, much higher. The rising cost of groceries beyond inflation is certainly a problem that a lot of workers are experiencing when they're trying to buy enough groceries for their families. Definitely across the province, but you know, especially in Halifax, the housing crisis, you know, the astronomical rates that people are paying for rent. And of course, you know, what happens when people are trying to look for housing? There's a lot of things that are going into these figures. And so we're seeing a lot of different crises converge all at once. And it's what's really making people feel the strain when it comes to their paycheck.
And how does this data that was collected help the Nova Scotia government to understand, you know, affordability challenges that they're facing right now?
This report shows that affordability is an issue in every region, you know, from Yarmouth to, you know, Glace Bay, Cape Breton, northern Nova Scotia. This is not really an affordable province to live in. And, you know, it may have been at one point, but it is among one of the more expensive places to live in Canada. You know, Halifax is right up there with a lot of our larger cities in Canada in terms of, you know, housing costs. The minimum wage needs to be much higher to reflect this basic reality. Be able to, you know, not spend half your paycheck on housing and, you know, be able to participate in the life of the community. Right now, we see sort of the negative impact of low wage work in a lot of our different systems. You know, healthcare workers see it, you know, in our hospitals and among their patients, you know, what the impact is of, you know, people not being able to live as healthy lives or afford their medication, as we are, you know, right now in a situation where we don't have enough family doctors and, you know, the system is struggling in a lot of ways. You know, I don't think we can afford to be adding to the strain of the healthcare system by continuing the system of, you know, low wage work and a low minimum wage. Employers simply need to be paying more, you know. Now, the minimum wage is that's kind of the level at which we say it should be illegal to pay less than this. But employers certainly don't have to do the bare minimum. British can and should be doing much more.
Double your pleasure and listen to the full story on canada-info.ca. People on social assistance in Quebec say they are feeling imprisoned and surveilled by authorities. Le ministère de l'Emploi et de la Solidarité sociale imposed travel limits on them in 2015. Since May 1st, 2015, most people receiving social assistance can't leave the province for more than a week at a time, with a cap of 15 days per month. In many other Canadian provinces, welfare recipients can be away for 30 days before seeing any penalty. Some welfare recipients are fighting back and organizing a campaign. Pauvre et Captif, or Poor and Captive, is the name of the campaign. And supporters of the campaign gathered outside the downtown Montreal office of Quebec's Premier François Legault on August 31st. More on this with journalist Jules Bougiel in Montreal, Quebec.
Supporters gathered outside a Montreal office of Premier François Legault last Thursday in protest of the rule and in support of an appeal before Quebec's Superior Court. That appeal is on a challenge that's already been twice rejected in the lower courts. Campaign members say the Quebec rules are among the strictest in Canada, and they're taking a toll on welfare recipients in the province.
Imagine having the stress of your loved one being sick and also maybe thinking of what the fuck will happen when I come back. It's like that for everything on welfare. You feel like you're being surveilled all the time. They don't do it actively because they don't have the means to do it, but they have the legal means to do it. If they could, they would, and when they need it, they will do it.
Speaking now is Nicolas Lemieux from the Comité des Personnes Assistées Sociales of Pointe-Saint-Charles. He says the new rules came about in response to a moral panic and public prejudice.
Many changes happened in the welfare law in 2015. It was supposed to go from 30 days to 14 days, so 2 weeks outside of the province. And when they talked about it in the public, it was about to be 14 days. People were shocked to know that welfare people were allowed to leave even. Some right-wing op-eds wrote like about welfare. They like got back to their préjugés and everything. And so they shrinked it from 14 days to 7 days, and like to show that they are hard on welfare people.
More concretely, he says it's a way to keep people from working outside the province and keep welfare costs low.
It's almost always based in prejudice and like false things, but there's rumors of people leaving Quebec to work elsewhere. If you're making money elsewhere, we won't give you money. So it's always, you know, the law is always based on condition, like giving you welfare in conditions of you staying here, or you searching for work, or you like cannot work. So you have to prove all the time that you cannot work, or you're too sick. So there's one reason. The other reason is it's like another way to cut on welfare also. That's our analysis. It's not their argument, but it's another way to control it and to make sure they don't spend too much on people on welfare.
But how does the government know? Lemieux says they aren't actively surveilling people, but if they find out you've been gone, a welfare recipient can be stuck with a big bill.
They have many ways to know if you use your debit cards or if you're leaving the country. They can have information from your passports. The thing is, when you sign in for welfare, you have to consent to make all your files, public or private, available to the minister. So they can use pretty much any like ways you can imagine to find out.
Lemieux says it's often your neighbors who'll report you to the government. It's not just the feeling of surveillance that takes a toll. The rule prevents many Quebecers from visiting loved ones outside the province or the country.
It's very tragic. In fact, it's kind of it's not like the first priority for them, like to be able to leave the country. They can think of housing or just food costs and everything, but it's still in the back of their heads. It's like when we talk about it, they realize it. They realize, like, I don't know my family anymore. Even if I could pay for it, or if they could pay for my voyage or something, it's not possible because of this ruling. So it's pretty sad. It's like they, when we talk about it, they kind of almost don't want to talk about it because it's too heavy.
Je trouve ça discriminatoire avec les gens qui peuvent pas voir sa famille à l'extérieur du Québec. Il faut que le gouvernement se mette à notre place pour qu'il voit les sentiments des gens.
This is Miguel, who asked not to release his full name for the story. He's a welfare recipient who came to Canada from Chile in 1995. He says the rule is discriminatory and asks officials to put themselves in his shoes. Here, he describes the death of his mother, father, and sister, all within the past several years. He says that he wasn't able to visit any of them during their illness in Chile, and that he's felt imprisoned as a result.
Oui, j'ai la famille au Chili. Je pouvais pas aller les visiter dans le temps de maladie. Oui, c'est sûr que j'étais malade parce que le bienfait social il coupe mon chèque. On dirait qu'on est emprisonné ici, là.
You can learn more about that campaign, as well as testimony from others who are affected by the ruling, online at pauvreetcaptif.com. I'm Jules Bigel. Thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
And now to Nanaimo, British Columbia, where the Oceanside Task Force is looking to establish a tiny home village for people who are experiencing homelessness in the area. The task force was inspired by a similar project conducted in Duncan, BC a few years ago. If all goes according to plan, a tiny home village with 20 to 24 units could open as early as late fall. That is, if municipalities in the area provide the necessary half acre of land for it. The Island Crisis Care Society is willing to operate the project, which would include 24-hour staffing and substance and mental health support for residents. This story by Mick Sweetman in Nanaimo, British Columbia.
The Oceanside Task Force on Homelessness is looking for land to create a village of tiny homes for people experiencing homelessness. In July, a motion at Parksville City Council for staff to identify possible land in the city for the project was deferred until the task force presented to the Qualicum Beach Council on Thursday. Violet Hayes, executive director of the Island Crisis Care Society, pitched Qualicum Beach Council on the idea, but the mayor said any decision would have to come back to a future council meeting. Hayes says that a trip to see a tiny home village in Duncan, which was established in 2020, prompted them to propose bringing the idea to other parts of Vancouver Island. I spoke with her over the phone about the plan.
In the summertime, a few of us went down to Duncan to have a look at what's been happening down there. They have the tiny home village down there. And so a few of us went down there to have a look, and we were very impressed with what we saw. So we thought, you know, this would be a really good temporary option until there's something more permanent in place in the Oceanside area.
Hayes says that the tiny home model helps provide a stepping stone from living on the street to supportive and market housing.
Often bringing people right from the streets into somewhere like Orca Place, it's just too much of a change. Whereas if you've got this interim piece, it really helps to build people's skills and get them ready for that next step.
Duncan Mayor Michelle Staples says the idea for a tiny home village in her city came from people who were living on the street.
One of the things that the peers brought up was they just needed a place. So they needed a place to, you know, either have a tent was one of the things that they said. and to not have too many people living together because not everybody gets along. But when COVID hit, we already had a model that the peers said would work, and we had an opportunity because of the pandemic to actually test it out. And from testing it out, we then discovered what worked, what didn't work, and we're able to grow off of that foundation. We didn't imagine this ourselves. This came from working with the people. For some people who are on the streets living in an institutional building, it just is not, it's not going to be conducive to them healing. This forms community.
I asked Staples what she would say to mayors and councillors in the Oceanside area who are considering a similar project.
What I would tell them is to bring everyone together, all the operations, people in your community with the city, RCMP, Island Health, and all the community service outreach organizations, peers, and come together to, you know, talk about the needs, the specific needs to of your community, because every community is going to be a little bit different, and come and visit the site here. Visit the site, talk to the people who are living there, talk to the operators of the site, learn from what we've learned, and then take that back to your community and build what will work for you.
Staples says that the tiny home village in Duncan has been such a success that she would like to see it become a permanent service in the city.
What we learned is that it works. It works for a vulnerable population that do not do well in other forms of housing, including supported housing that are being built right now in our communities and others. Those are great for some people. But what we've learned is for really vulnerable people that this site, as a first from being on the street to becoming stabilized, this is a key step for people to be successful, to be able to prepare for, you know, their next step in life, whatever that looks like. And it will be different for different people. And so we're really working to actually establish this as a form of transitional housing for people. We would like, not in this spot, because we know we have to move it because it was a temporary site. The actual land is only available for a certain amount of time. So we would like to move it and establish it as a permanent transitional site.
Hayes says that not only would a similar site in Oceanside benefit the people who live there, but also the broader community.
I think it's for the good of the community as a whole. I mean, we see a lot of issues happening in the communities around homelessness and concerns, and it's the right thing to do. I mean, everyone has a right to have a home. And I think if we can do something in the short term that, you know, gives people some dignity and a place to call their own off of the streets and being able to move forward, I think we should be doing it.
This is Mick Sweetman.
And now to Ontario, where more than a decade ago, a bunch of students fought to keep their school from closing by giving a little hell to authorities. That story has now been captured in a theatrical production about student activism. It's called Give 'em Hell. The play tells the story of Peterborough Collegiate Vocational School's PCVS closure and the students' 12-month fight to keep it open. The local theatrical production focuses on the protests, actions, and personal developments of the Raiders in Action, the student activist group, and the play will have a feeling of déjà vu as it will be performed by a cast of local teen actors in the auditorium of the former PCVS building, built in 1827 and closed since 2012. Comedian and Canadian actor Rick Mercer from The Rick Mercer Report even got involved in the 2012 campaign and remembers the fight the students put up to keep their school open. Mercer is even featured as a character in the play because of his involvement with the story. From Peterborough, Ontario, here's Edward Sweeney.
An important moment in Peterborough's history is being revisited this September with Theatre Direct's production of Give 'em Hell, which tells a story about the 2012 closure of Peterborough's downtown high school, Peterborough Collegiate Vocational School, also known as PCVS. The building is currently open under a different name, usually referred to as PACE, but it will be called PCVS for the remainder of this story. The play, written by a local playwright and starring local teen actors, premieres on September 15th, right in the PCVS auditorium.
Give 'em Hell chronicles the final school year at PCVS, starting in September 2011 through to June 2012, and it focuses on the protests and actions and personal developments of the Raiders in Action, which were the student activist group.
That was playwright Madeline Brown talking about where this story comes from. Brown grew up in Peterborough and moved to Toronto to pursue acting. It was never Brown's intention to write plays, she says, but through a series of connections and circumstances, including a dare, she got the opportunity of writing her first play for Toronto Fringe Festival. Since then, Brown has written and produced multiple shows in both Toronto and Stratford. After only about 3 weeks of rehearsals, the cast of Give 'Em Hell will premiere the play in the PCVS Auditorium. But the production process has been going on far longer than that.
So the development of the play started in 2020, and I worked closely with Aaron Jan, who is the director on the play, and was also the dramaturg, which is essentially like an editor in the playwriting process. And so we worked together, and also that's when I started to build relationships with partners like Theatre Direct, Fourth Line Theatre, and Peterborough Museum and Archives, as they supported various iterations of that development. And that brings us up until probably last summer.
Brown did not actually attend PCVS, but she went to another Peterborough high school, Adam Scott CVI, around the same time that the events of the play were happening. And since Brown couldn't use her own experience to tell this story, PCVS students and alumni were brought into the Give 'Em Hell writing process early on.
So I had a lot of phone and Zoom calls with people who were part of that year, and many people who I myself, because we were the same age, had sort of connected with through other activities in Peterborough and extracurriculars. But no, it was the highlight of my 2020 in some years because, again, there was such a lack of connection and socialization in general. But for me, I had this great sort of source material and jumping off point to then, as a way in, to talk to people about their experience. And I think what struck me most about it, because at that point we would have been 8 years after the fact, was just how strong and clear the feelings and thoughts were from that experience.
I got to speak with one of the alumni involved with the writing of Give 'Em Hell. Colin Chapika attended PCVS the years leading up to the closure and became one of the organizers of the group of student activists working to keep the school open, the Raiders in Action.
I think it was probably about a year ago that Madeline first got in touch with me when she had let me know that she was thinking about writing the script and that it was in development. So she just reached out and said, hey, do you mind doing a quick little interview with me to talk about your experience? And we got into some like a lot of the personal details, and that's actually reflective in the show. She's done a great job of amalgamating not just my experience, but a bunch of other students' experiences into the two main characters and a lot of the side characters.
It is also important to learn what happened during that year leading up to the school's closure, and I wanted to hear it from people who were involved.
And they originally decided that they were going to close Thomas A. Stewart, and then 3 days before they were supposed to vote on that, they switched the recommendation to PCVS. So a group of students decided, you know, we would make a bunch of noise at the school board meeting, and then they eventually decided to close PCVS. So that group just kind of continued going forward, trying to raise awareness about why this school was so special. And throughout the course of the year, we put on numerous protests, with the biggest one being busing like 400 students to Queen's Park from PCVS. And then we raised a bunch of money for Spread the Net, and we got Rick Mercer to come to the school and he filmed a segment there. But ultimately, at the end of the day, PCVS did close and we all had to move on.
Well, it was like almost being in a John Hughes movie from the 80s, because we were doing the Spread the Net challenge. Of course, schools were raising money to purchase bed nets for distribution in countries in Africa, and I would visit the winning school. And this one school, out of the blue, just knocked it out of the park. I believe they raised $52,000, which was an astounding amount of money. But then I found out they had a double agenda, a dual agenda. They did want to raise money for Spread the Net, but they also wanted to win that prize because it would mean that I would come to the school and I would put their school on television. And they felt in their heart of hearts that if this opportunity came along and their school was put on television, the province would see the error in the ways of closing the school that these students were so incredibly passionate about. And so it was like the plot of an 80s movie.
That was Rick Mercer, Canadian comedian and host of The Rick Mercer Report, the television show that featured PCVS on an episode. Mercer occupies an important role in this story. Filming the episode of The Rick Mercer Report was such a memorable experience for everyone involved that Mercer is actually featured as a character in Give 'Em Hell. In addition to that, the title of the play, Give 'Em Hell, is influenced by Mercer's words to the students. He told the students to fight like hell, and the entire school came together to film a music video to the song Raise a Little Hell by Trooper, which was featured in that episode. It's clear that these students were passionate about fighting for their school, but why did they care? What were they fighting for? What made PCVS so special? A common answer is the building itself. Originally built in 1827, like 16-year-old cast member Edie Burton says here.
Definitely the setting. This school is incredible. I did not think that we would be acting here, like reliving, you know, what really happened.
Because it was like just this beautiful old building and like, you know, colonial style, but like giant hallways with hardwood floors and like this beautiful auditorium and a marble staircase. It was a lovely place to be every day.
But for the students and community members, it was more than any one specific thing that made PCVS worth fighting for.
The term safe space gets thrown around a lot these days, but before I even knew what that meant, that was the experience of PCVS. A lot of people describe it as it was like being hugged when you walked into the school by the building and just by all the staff and the support. It was a special place for a lot of marginalized folks, like queer and LGBTQS people, as well as inner city kids. And also, there was a lot of first-generation immigrants who were attending the ESL program. So it was this really interesting mix of a bunch of different cultures, and it, unlike the typical high school experience you see in a lot of movies and stuff, everyone was just kind of chill and relaxed, and really there was no big stinks about who you are, and it was a safe space to play with your identity and figure out exactly what you wanted to do moving forward.
And how important the school was to people as a place that was, I don't know, very open and accepting of people of the LGBTQ community, when many schools at the time were pretty iffy about it.
But PCVS was like visiting another planet. It was just, well, for starters, it was such a beautiful building. The students there were so passionate about saving the school, and that was across the board. I went to a school that was considered a very good school, but if they had announced they were closing the school, I don't think half the students would care one way or another. And this was entirely driven by students in their final year of school. So they were trying to save the school for future generations. It wasn't even for them. It was completely selfless.
With PCVS having been around for so long, it's quite common for families to have multiple members who attended the school, like Burton's.
PCVS is also a school that is in like a lot of my family's history. My dad went here, my uncle, my aunt.
But Give 'Em Hell is not really about the school. It's about the students fighting for the school. In each of my interviews, I asked why this story is still relevant and why people should come see this show now.
Looking back on the closure and like the big stink we put up, you know, when it was all going down, it felt very isolated and very local. But why I think the story itself is important and why I'm very happy to see it reflected in the play is that it fits into a broader structure and pattern of youth activism. And again, I think really paying attention to what the youth see the future and what they want the future to be is fundamentally important moving forward in our political world right now.
And also, I think often when we talk about youth activism, we look at it in this kind of sort of glorified or cutesy way. And I think for me, it's important to look at the real struggles and challenges of being a young person and fighting for a cause.
Well, I knew at the time I was witnessing something quite profound, because I was witnessing this awakening of activism in these young people who saw a situation they didn't like and they decided to fight like hell.
This has been Eddie Sweeney reporting for the Local Journalism Initiative.
And this concludes this edition of Viewpoints. Thanks to our team of journalists this week, Mick Sweetman in Nanaimo, British Columbia, Jules Bugiel in Montreal, Quebec, Edward Sweeney in Peterborough, Ontario, and Haley DiRizio in Halifax, Nova Scotia. To our national editors, Victoria Fenner in Toronto and Maureen McEwen in Ottawa, Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in Ottawa. I'm Boris Chassaigne, your host and producer in Montreal. Please stay tuned to the show that follows. Thanks for keeping us company. Until next week, ciao.
LJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.